Parmenides. When we arrived in Athens from our home in Clazomenae, we ran into Adeimantus and Glaucon in the marketplace. Adeimantus took my hand and said, "Welcome, Cephalus. If there's anything here we can help with, just say so." "As it happens," I said, "that's exactly why I've come to ask a favor of you." "Then name it," he said. And I said, "What was the name of your half-brother on your mother's side? I don't remember." "He was just a boy when I was here before, visiting from Clazomenae, and that was a long time ago now. His father, I think, was named Pyrilamps." "That's right," he said. "And the boy himself, Antiphon, but why do you ask?" "These men," I said, "are fellow citizens of mine, quite devoted to philosophy, and they've heard that this Antiphon spent a great deal of time with a certain Pythodorus, a companion of Zeno's, and that he has memorized the arguments that Socrates, Zeno, and Parmenides once discussed, having heard them often from Pythodorus." "True enough," he said. "Well, we'd like to hear them." "That's no trouble," he said. "When he was a young man, he worked hard at mastering them, though these days, like his grandfather and namesake, he spends most of his time with horses. But if you like, let's go find him. He just went home from here, and he lives nearby, in Melite." With that, we set off walking, and found Antiphon at home, handing a bridle over to a smith to have it fitted. Once the smith had gone, his brothers told him why we had come, and he recognized me from my earlier visit and greeted me warmly. When we asked him to go through the arguments, he hesitated at first, saying it was a great deal of work, but then he told the whole story. Antiphon said that Pythodorus told him that Zeno and Parmenides once came to Athens for the great Panathenaea. Parmenides was already quite an old man, his hair very white, but handsome and of noble bearing, somewhere around 65. Zeno at that time was nearly 40, tall and good-looking, and was said to have been Parmenides' beloved. They were staying with Pythodorus, outside the city wall in the Ceramicus, and Socrates went there, along with a good many others, all eager to hear Zeno's writings. For that was the first time they had been brought to Athens by their authors. Socrates was very young at the time. Zeno himself read the arguments aloud to them, while Parmenides happened to be out. Pythodorus said that only a small part of the arguments remained to be read when he himself came in from outside, together with Parmenides and Aristotle, the same man who later became one of the 30, and that they caught just a little of what was being read. Not that it mattered to him, since he had heard it all before from Zeno. When Socrates had listened, he asked Zeno to read the first hypothesis of the first argument again, and once it had been read, he said, "What do you mean by this, Zeno? If existing things are many, then, you say, they must be both like and unlike. But that's impossible, since unlike things cannot be like, nor like things unlike. Isn't that your claim?" "Yes," said Zeno. "Then, if it's impossible for unlike things to be like and like things unlike, it's also impossible for there to be many things, since if there were many, they would suffer these impossibilities. Is this the point of your arguments, simply to fight, against every common claim, the thesis that things are many? And do you take each of your arguments as proof of exactly this, so that you think you're offering as many proofs that there aren't many things as you've written arguments? Is that your meaning, or have I misunderstood?" "No," said Zeno, "you've grasped very well the overall point of the piece." "I see, Parmenides," said Socrates, "that Zeno here wants to be linked with you not only in friendship, but in his writing too. He's written, in a way, the same thing you have, but by changing the presentation, he tries to make us think he's saying something different. You claim in your poems that the all is one, and you give fine, solid proofs of it. He, for his part, claims that it isn't many, and he too offers a great abundance of impressive proofs. So when one of you says one and the other says not many, and each of you speaks in such a way that you seem to be saying nothing the same, though you're really saying almost the same thing, what you've both said seems to go over the heads of the rest of us." "Yes, Socrates," said Zeno, "but you haven't caught the whole truth of the piece. Still, like a Spartan hound, you track and chase down what's said quite well. First, though, you're missing this. The piece doesn't put on such airs as you suppose, as if it were written with some grand design in mind to hide something important from people. What you mentioned is only incidental. The real truth is that this writing comes to the defense of Parmenides' argument against those who try to make fun of it, by claiming that if it's one, the argument runs into many absurd and self-contradictory results. So this piece answers those who assert the many and gives back the same treatment and more, aiming to show that their hypothesis, that things are many, would end up in even more absurd trouble than the hypothesis that it's one if someone examined it thoroughly enough. I wrote it in that competitive spirit when I was young, and someone stole it once it was written, so I never even got the chance to decide whether to publish it or not. That's what you're missing, Socrates. You assume it was written from a young man's love of argument, rather than an older man's ambition for reputation. Though, as I said, your guess wasn't far off. Well, I accept that, said Socrates, and I think it's just as you say. But tell me this. Don't you think there is a form of likeness, itself by itself, and again another form opposite to it, which is unlikeness, and that you and I and the other things we call many come to share in these two? And that whatever shares in likeness becomes like, in that respect, and to the degree it shares in it, while whatever shares in unlikeness becomes unlike, and whatever shares in both becomes both. And even if all things share in both, being opposite as they are, and by partaking of both are like and unlike themselves. What's so strange in that? If someone showed that the likes themselves become unlike, or the unlikes like, that would be a marvel. But if he shows that things which share in both undergo both, there's nothing odd in that, Zeno, to my mind. Nor is it odd if someone shows that all things are one by sharing in the one, and that these same things are also many by sharing in multitude. But if he shows that what is itself one is many, and that the many are, in turn, one itself, now that would astonish me. And likewise with everything else. If he can show that the kinds and forms themselves undergo these opposite conditions in themselves, that's worth marveling at. But if he shows that I am one in many, what's strange in that, when to show me as many he says that my right side is different from my left, my front from my back, my top from my bottom, since I do partake of multitude, while to show me as one, he'll say that though we are seven, I am one man, sharing also in the one. So both are shown to be true. If then someone tries to show that the very same things, sticks, stones, and the like, are many and one, we'll say he's shown something to be many and one, not that the one is many or the many one, and that he said nothing marvelous, only what we'd all agree to. But if someone first distinguishes, each by itself, the forms themselves, likeness, unlikeness, multitude, unity, rest, motion, and all such things, and then shows that these in themselves can be mixed together and separated, that, Zeno, is what I would admire. I think what you've done here has been argued with real courage. But I'd admire it far more if someone could show this same puzzle woven all through the forms themselves, just as you've shown it in the visible world, and display it likewise in the realm grasped by reasoning. Pythagoras said that as Socrates spoke, he himself expected that Parmenides and Zeno would grow annoyed at each point, but instead they paid him close attention, glancing at each other from time to time and smiling, as if in admiration of Socrates. And indeed, when Socrates finished, Parmenides said just that. Socrates, you deserve admiration for your eagerness in argument. Now tell me, have you yourself drawn this distinction you speak of, separating certain forms, on the one hand, from the things that share in them, on the other? And do you think there is such a thing as likeness itself, apart from the likeness we ourselves have, and one and many, and all the things you just heard Zeno discuss? I do, said Socrates. And also things like these, said Parmenides, such as a form of justice itself, by itself, and of beauty and goodness and all such things. Yes, he said. And a form of man, apart from us and all those like us, some form itself of man, or of fire, or of water. I've often been at a loss, Parmenides, whether to say the same about these as about the others, or not. And what about things like these, Socrates, which might seem quite laughable, hair, mud, dirt, or anything else utterly worthless and trivial? Are you at a loss whether to say there is a form for each of these two, separate from the things we handle, or not? Not at all, said Socrates. These things are just what we see them to be, It would be too absurd to suppose there's a form of them. Though sometimes the worry does strike me that the same might hold for everything. But then, when I take that stand, I flee, afraid of tumbling into some abyss of nonsense and being destroyed. So I go back to the things we agreed do have forms, and spend my time on those. That's because you're still young, Socrates, said Parmenides, and philosophy hasn't yet taken hold of you the way it will, in my judgment, when you'll no longer look down on any of these things. For now, you still defer to people's opinions, because of your age. But tell me this. Do you think, as you say, that there are certain forms from which the other things, by partaking of them, take their names, so that things partaking of likeness become like, of largeness become large, and of beauty and justice become beautiful and just? Certainly, said Socrates. So whatever partakes of the form partakes either of the whole of it or of a part of it. Or could there be some other way of partaking, apart from these two? How could there be? He said, well then, do you think the whole form is present in each of the many things, being one, or how? What's to stop it being one? Said Socrates. Then, being one and the same, it will be present whole at the same time in many things that are separate from one another, and so it will be separate from itself. No, it won't, he said. Not if it's like a day, one and the same day can be in many places at once without being separate from itself in the least. Suppose each of the forms is one, and the same in all its instances, in just that way. How neatly you make one and the same thing be in many places at once, Socrates, as if you spread a sail over a number of people, and then said one whole thing was over many. Isn't that the sort of thing you mean? Perhaps, he said. Well then, would the sail be whole over each person, or would a different part of it be over each? A part. So the forms themselves are divisible, Socrates, and the things that share in them would share in a part of them, and no longer would the whole form be in each thing, but only a part of it in each. So it appears, at any rate. Then will you be willing, Socrates, to say that the one form is really divided up and still remains one? Not at all, he said. Consider this, he said. If you divide up largeness itself, and each of the many large things is large by a smaller part of largeness than largeness itself, won't that seem absurd? It certainly will, he said. And what about this? If something takes off a small part of the equal, will what has that part, which is less than the equal itself, be equal to anything by it? Impossible. But suppose one of us has a part of the small itself will be larger than this part, since it is a part of it, and so the small itself will turn out larger. And whatever the removed piece is added to will become smaller, not larger than before. That could never happen, he said. Then in what way, Socrates, he said, will the other things come to share in your forms if they can partake of them neither part by part nor as wholes? By Zeus, he said, it doesn't seem to me an easy thing to settle at all. Well now, what do you say to this? To what? I imagine it's something like this that makes you think each form is one. Whenever a number of things seem large to you, there seems, perhaps, looking at them all, to be some one identical character over them, and that's why you take the large to be one. True, he said. But what about largeness itself and the other large things? If you look at all of them the same way in your mind, won't some further one large thing appear, by which all of these appear large? It seems so. So another form of largeness will show up, arising alongside largeness itself and the things that share in it, and over all of these again another, by which all of them will be large. And each of your forms will no longer be one, but unlimited in number. But Parmenides, said Socrates, maybe each of these forms is a thought, and it's not right for it to arise anywhere except in minds. In that way, each would be one, and would no longer suffer what was just described. Well then, he said, is each of these thoughts one but a thought of nothing? No, that's impossible, he said. A thought of something then? Yes. Of something that is, or that is not. Of something that is. Of some one thing, which that thought thinks is present over all the instances, some single character. Yes. Then won't this thing that is thought to be one be a form, always the same over all the instances? That seems necessary again. Well then, said Parmenides, given the necessity by which you say the other things share in the forms, doesn't it follow that either each thing is made of thoughts and everything thinks, or else that they are thoughts which do not think? That doesn't make sense either, he said. No, Parmenides, what appears to me most likely is this. These forms stand fixed in nature like patterns, and the other things resemble them and are likenesses of them. And this sharing that the other things come to have in the forms is simply their being modeled on them. Well, he said, if something resembles the form, can that form fail to be like the thing modeled on it, to the extent that it has been made like it? Or is there any way for a likeness not to be like its like? There is not. And isn't it a great necessity that the like share in one and the same form as its like? It is. And won't the thing by sharing in which like things are like be the form itself? Absolutely. So it's not possible for anything to be like the form, nor the form like anything else. Otherwise, alongside the form another form will always appear, and if that one is like anything, yet another again, and it will never stop, new forms constantly arising, if the form comes to be like what shares in it. That's very true. So it isn't by likeness that the other things share in the forms. Some other means of sharing must be sought. So it seems. Do you see then, Socrates, he said, how great the difficulty is if one marks the forms off as being just by themselves? I do indeed. Then be assured, he said, that you haven't even begun to touch how great the difficulty is, so to speak, if you're going to posit one form for each existing thing, marking it off every time. How so? He said. There are many other reasons, he said, but the greatest is this. Suppose someone said that the forms, being what we say they must be, aren't even the sort of thing that can be known. No one could show that person he was wrong, unless the one arguing against him happened to be widely experienced and not lacking in ability, and were willing to follow the demonstrator through a long and far-ranging argument. Otherwise, the one who insists that the forms are unknowable would remain unpersuaded. How so, Parmenides? Said Socrates. Because, Socrates, I think you, and anyone else who posits that each thing has some being that exists just by itself, would agree, first, that none of these beings exists in us. How could it still be itself by itself if it did? Said Socrates. Well put, he said. So all the forms that are what they are in relation to one another have their being in relation to themselves, not in relation to the things among us, whether we take these as likenesses or however else one posits them, things which, by sharing in them, give us each our names. And these things among us, though they share a name with those forms, are themselves again in relation to themselves, not in relation to the forms, and belong to themselves, not to those other things that are likewise named. What do you mean? Said Socrates. For instance, said Parmenides, if one of us is master or slave of someone, he is not, of course, slave of mastery itself of what mastery is, nor is the master, master of slavery itself of what slavery is. Rather, being a man, he is these things in relation to a man. But mastery itself is what it is in relation to slavery itself, and slavery likewise is itself in relation to mastery itself. The things among us do not have their power in relation to those, nor do those have theirs in relation to us. Rather, as I say, those things are themselves in relation to themselves and belong to one another, and the things among us are likewise in relation to themselves. Or don't you follow what I mean? I follow perfectly well, said Socrates. Then knowledge too, he said. Knowledge itself, what it is, would be knowledge of truth itself, what it is. Certainly. And each particular kind of knowledge, what it is, would be knowledge of some particular thing that is, what it is, isn't that so? Yes. But the knowledge that exists among us would be knowledge of the truth among us, and each kind of knowledge among us would turn out to be knowledge of some particular thing among us. Necessarily. But indeed, as you agree, we neither possess the forms themselves nor can they exist among us. No, we can't. And the kinds themselves, what each of them is, are known, surely, by the form of knowledge itself.
Yes.
Which we don't possess.
No, we don't.
Then none of the forms is known by us, since we have no share in knowledge itself.
It seems not.
So the beautiful itself, what it is, and the good, and all the things we take to be forms existing in themselves, are unknowable to us.
It looks that way.
Now see something still more alarming than this.
What is it?
You'd surely agree that if there is indeed some kind of knowledge itself, it's far more exact than the knowledge that exists among us, and the same for beauty and everything else.
Yes.
So if anything else shares in knowledge itself, wouldn't you say no one has the most exact knowledge more than a god does?
Necessarily.
Then will a god, having knowledge itself, be able to know the things among us?
Why not?
Because, Parmenides said, we've agreed that those forms don't have the power they have in relation to the things among us, nor do the things among us have theirs in relation to those forms. Each set has power only in relation to itself.
Yes, we've agreed to that.
Then if the most exact mastery and the most exact knowledge are with the God, that mastery of theirs could never rule us, nor could that knowledge know us or anything else among us. Rather, just as we do not govern them with our authority, nor know anything divine by our knowledge, so too, by the same reasoning, they, being gods, are neither our masters nor do they know human affairs. But surely, he said, this is far too strange an argument if it's going to deprive God of knowing.
And yet, Socrates, said Parmenides, these difficulties and many others besides are unavoidable for the forms. If these characters of things really exist, and one is going to mark off each form as a thing itself, so that the listener is left at a loss, and disputes whether they exist at all, and, if they do exist as much as possible, insists they must be altogether unknowable to human nature. And in saying this, he seems to be saying something, and, as we said just now, he's remarkably hard to talk out of it. It would take a truly gifted man to grasp that there is a kind and a being in itself for each thing, and a still more remarkable one to discover this, and be able to teach someone else who has worked it all out with sufficient rigor.
I grant you that, Parmenides, said Socrates. You're speaking very much to my own mind. And yet, Socrates, said Parmenides, if someone, in light of all these difficulties and others like them, refuses to allow that there are forms of things, and won't mark off a form for each single thing, he won't have anywhere to turn his thought, since he won't allow that the character of each thing is always the same, and so he'll utterly destroy the power of discourse. It's this consequence, I think, that you've noticed especially well.
That's true, he said.
Then what will you do about philosophy? Which way will you turn, with all this left unresolved?
I don't see my way clear at all, at least for the present.
That's because you're trying too soon, Socrates, before you've been properly trained, to define the beautiful, the just, the good, and each of the other forms. I noticed this the other day too, listening to you talking here with Aristotle. The impulse you feel toward argument is a fine and godlike one, be assured, but pull yourself back and train yourself more, while you're still young. In that discipline, the many consider useless and call idle chatter. Otherwise, the truth will slip past you.
Then what is this discipline, Parmenides? He said. What form does the training take?
The one you heard from Zeno, he said. Except that there was one thing you said to him that I admired. You wouldn't let him confine the wandering inquiry to visible things and what concerns them, but made him range over those things that one could most grasp by reasoning and would take to be forms.
Yes, he said, because it seems to me there's no difficulty at all, this way, in showing that visible things are both like and unlike, and undergo anything else whatever.
Yes, and rightly so, he said. But there's something else you should do besides this. Not only suppose that each thing is, and examine what follows from that supposition, but also suppose that the same thing is not, if you want to get more practice.
What do you mean?
Said Socrates. Take, for instance, he said, if you like, this hypothesis that Zeno proposed, that things are many, You should examine what must follow both for the many themselves in relation to each other and in relation to the one, and for the one in relation to itself and in relation to the many. And again, if things are not many, you must examine in turn what will follow for the one and for the many, both in relation to themselves and in relation to each other. And yet again, if you suppose that likeness exists or that it does not exist, you must ask what follows in each case, both for the things supposed and for everything else, both in relation to themselves and to each other. And the same method applies to unlikeness, to motion and to rest, to coming to be and passing away, and to being itself and not being. In a word, whatever you ever suppose to exist or not to exist, or to undergo any other affection, you must examine what follows, both in relation to the thing itself and in relation to each of the other things, whichever you choose, and in relation to several of them and to all of them together. And likewise the other things too, both in relation to themselves and in relation to whatever else you choose, always, whether you suppose the thing you posited to exist or not to exist, if you're going to train yourself fully and see the truth clearly in the end. That's an overwhelming task you're describing, Parmenides, he said, and I don't quite follow it. Why don't you go through it yourself, taking some hypothesis, so I can understand it better? That's a lot to ask of a man my age, Socrates, he said. Well, Zeno, said Socrates, why don't you go through it for us? And Zeno, he said, laughed and said, let's ask Parmenides himself, Socrates, this is no light matter he's describing. Don't you see what a task you're setting him? If there were more of us, it wouldn't be right to ask this of him. Talking about such things in front of a large crowd isn't fitting, especially for a man his age. Most people don't realize that without this thorough excursion through everything, this wandering, it's impossible to arrive at the truth with understanding. So I join Socrates in asking you, Parmenides, so that I too can hear it again after all this time. When Zeno had said this, Antiphon said that Pythodorus told him that he himself, along with Aristotle and the others, joined in asking Parmenides to demonstrate what he meant and not refuse. So Parmenides said, I must do as you ask then. And yet I feel I'm in the position of Ibycus's horse, the one that, being an old racehorse about to compete in a chariot race, trembled at what was coming because it knew from experience what it meant, and Ibycus, comparing himself to it, said that he too, old as he was being forced against his will into love. I feel much the same, remembering how frightened I am at how, at my age, I'm to swim across such a vast sea of arguments. Still, I must oblige you, since, as Zeno says, we're all friends here. So where should we begin, and what should we suppose first? Since it seems we're to play this laborious game, shall I begin from myself and my own hypothesis, taking the one itself as my subject, and asking what must follow whether it is one or not one? Yes, do that, said Zeno. Then who will answer my questions? He said, the youngest one, perhaps. He'd be least likely to make trouble, and would answer just what he thinks, and at the same time his answers would give me a rest. I'm ready for that, Parmenides, said Aristotle. You mean me, when you say the youngest. Go ahead and ask, and I'll answer. Very well, he said. If it is one, the one couldn't be many, could it? How could it? So it must have neither part nor be a whole. Why not? Because a part is part of a whole. Yes. And what is a whole? Isn't it that from which no part is missing? Certainly. So in both ways the one would consist of parts, both as being a whole and as having parts. Necessarily. So in both ways the one would turn out to be many, not one. True. But it must be not many but one itself. It must. So it will be neither a whole nor have parts, if it is to be one. No, it won't. Now if it has no part, it can have neither beginning, nor end, nor middle, for such things would already be parts of it. Right. And surely an end and a beginning are the limit of anything. Of course. So the one is unlimited, if it has neither beginning nor end. Unlimited. And also without shape, for it partakes of neither the round nor the straight. How so? The round, surely, is that whose extremities are everywhere equally distant from the middle.
Yes.
And the straight is that whose middle stands in front of both extremities.
Just so.
So the one would have parts and be many, whether it partook of straight or of round shape.
Certainly.
So it is neither straight nor round, since it has no parts at all.
Right.
And being such, it could be nowhere, for it would be neither in another nor in itself.
How so?
If it were in another, it would be surrounded on all sides by that in which it was contained, and would touch it at many points with many parts of itself. But what is one and partless, and has no share of roundness, cannot possibly touch something all around in a circle.
Impossible.
But then again, if it were in itself, it would be surrounded by nothing other than itself, since it would indeed be in itself, for it's impossible for a thing to be in something that doesn't contain it.
Impossible indeed.
So the container would be one thing and the contained another, for the same whole thing can't both undergo and produce the same effect at once. And in that way, the one would no longer be one but two.
That's right.
So the one is not anywhere, being contained neither in itself nor in another.
It isn't.
Now consider whether, being so, it's possible for it to be at rest or in motion.
Why shouldn't it be?
Because if it moved, it would either be carried along or be altered. Those are the only kinds of motion.
Yes.
But the one, being altered from itself, surely couldn't still be one.
Impossible.
So it doesn't move by alteration, at least.
Apparently not.
Then does it move by being carried along?
Perhaps.
But if the one were carried along, it would either revolve in a circle in the same place, or shift from one place to another.
It must be one or the other.
Now, if it revolves in a circle, it must be fixed on a center, and the parts moving around the center must be other parts of itself. But for something to which neither center nor parts belong, what mechanism could ever carry it in a circle around a center?
None.
But does it move by changing places, coming to be now here, now there?
If it moves at all, yes.
But wasn't it shown to be impossible for it to be in anything?
Yes.
Then isn't it even more impossible for it to come to be in something?
I don't see how.
If a thing comes to be in something, mustn't it be that it isn't yet entirely in it while still coming to be, and yet isn't entirely outside it either, since it's already coming to be in it?
Necessarily.
So if anything else is to undergo this, only that which has parts could undergo it, for part of it would already be in the thing and part outside at the same time. But what has no parts can't possibly, as a whole, be neither wholly inside nor wholly outside something.
True.
And what has neither parts nor is a whole. It even more impossible for it to come to be in something, since it can come to be neither part by part nor as a whole.
So it seems.
So it neither shifts place by going somewhere and coming to be in it, nor revolves in the same place, nor is altered.
It seems not.
So in every kind of motion, the one is unmoved.
Unmoved.
But we also said it's impossible for it to be in anything.
Yes, we did.
So it's never in the same place either.
Why?
Because it would then be in that very thing in which it is the same.
Certainly.
But it was impossible for it to be in itself or in another.
Yes, it was.
So the one is never in the same place.
It seems not.
But what's never in the same place, neither stays still nor is at rest.
No, it can't be.
So the one, it seems, is neither at rest nor in motion.
So it appears.
Nor again will it be the same as another or as itself, nor different from itself or from another.
How so?
If it were different from itself, it would be different from one, and so wouldn't be one.
True.
And if it were the same as another, it would be that other thing and not itself. So it wouldn't be what it in fact is, namely one, but something different from one.
Just so.
So it won't be the same as another, or different from itself.
No.
Nor will it be different from another, so long as it's one, for it doesn't belong to one to be different from anything, That belongs only to different, in relation to different, and to nothing else.
Right. So by virtue of being one, it won't be different.
No, indeed.
But if not by virtue of that, then not by virtue of itself, and if not by virtue of itself, then not itself, and being in no way different, it will be different from nothing.
Right.
Nor again will it be the same as itself.
How so?
Because the nature of the one isn't, surely, the same as the nature of the same.
Why?
Because a thing doesn't become one whenever it becomes the same as something.
What then?
Whatever becomes the same as the many must become many, not one.
True.
But if the one and the same didn't differ at all, then whenever a thing became the same, it would always become one, and whenever one, the same.
Quite so.
So if the one is to be the same as itself, it won't be one with itself, and thus, being one, it won't be one.
But that's impossible. So it's impossible for the one to be either different from another or the same as itself.
Impossible. So the one could not be either different or the same, either in relation to itself or in relation to another.
No, it couldn't.
Nor again will it be like or unlike anything, either itself or another.
Why?
Because whatever has undergone the same is, presumably, like.
Yes.
But the same was shown to have a nature separate from the one.
Yes, it was.
But if the one has undergone anything apart from being one, it would have undergone being more than one, and that's impossible.
Yes.
So the one can in no way have undergone the same as anything, either another or itself.
It seems not.
So it can't possibly be like anything, either another or itself.
It seems not.
Nor, again, has the one undergone being different, for in that way too it would have undergone being more than one.
Yes, more.
But what has undergone being different from itself or from another would be unlike itself or another, since what has undergone the same is like.
Right.
But the one, it seems, having in no way undergone being different, is in no way unlike either itself or another.
No, indeed.
So the one could be neither like nor unlike, either another or itself.
It appears not.
And being such, it will be neither equal nor unequal, either to itself or to another.
How so?
Being equal, it will be of the same measures as that to which it's equal.
Yes.
And being greater or smaller, in relation to things commensurate with it, it will have more measures than the smaller things and fewer than the larger.
Yes.
And in relation to things not commensurate with it, it will have smaller measures in one case and larger in the other.
Of course.
But isn't it impossible for a thing that has no share in sameness to have the same measures, or anything else the same, as another?
Impossible.
So it won't be equal to itself or to another, having no share of the same measures.
It doesn't appear so.
But if it has more or fewer measures, it will have just as many parts as it has measures, and in this way again, it will no longer be one, but as many as its measures are.
Right.
And if it were of one measure, it would become equal to that measure. But that was shown to be impossible for it to be equal to anything.
Yes, it was.
So having no share of one measure, or of many, or of few, and no share of the same at all, it will never, it seems, be equal to itself or to another. Nor again will it be greater or smaller than itself or than another.
Just so, altogether.
Well then, does it seem possible for the one to be older or younger, or to have the same age as anything?
Why shouldn't it?
Because if it had the same age as itself or another, it would share in equality and likeness of time, and we said the one had no share in either likeness or equality.
Yes, we did say that.
And we also said it has no share of unlikeness or inequality.
Quite so.
So how could it be older or younger than anything, or the same age as anything, being such as this?
No way at all.
Then the one would be neither younger nor older nor the same age, either as itself or as anything else.
It doesn't appear so.
Well then, could the one exist in time at all, if it's like that? Or isn't it necessary, if a thing is in time,
that it's always becoming older than itself. Necessary. And what's older is always older than something younger.
Of course.
So a thing becoming older than itself is at the same time becoming younger than itself, if indeed it's going to have something than which it becomes older.
What do you mean?
Like this. A thing that's already different from another doesn't need to become different, it already is. But what has become different has become so, what is going to be different is going to become so, and what is becoming different has neither become, nor is going to become, nor is yet different, but is in the process of becoming so, and can't be otherwise. That's certainly necessary. But older is difference from younger, and from nothing else.
It is.
So a thing becoming older than itself must also, at the same time, be becoming younger than itself.
So it seems.
And further, it can't take a longer or shorter time than itself in becoming. It takes exactly the same time, both becoming and being and having become and being going to be.
Yes, that too is necessary.
So it seems necessary, then, that anything in time, anything that shares in this, must have exactly the same age as itself, and at the same time, must be becoming both older and younger than itself.
It looks that way.
But the one had no share in any of these conditions.
No, it had no share.
Then it has no share in time either, and doesn't exist in any time.
No, at least not by the argument's own reckoning.
Well, now don't was and has become, and was becoming, seem to signify a sharing in time gone by.
They certainly do.
And don't will be, and will become, and will come to be signify time yet to come.
Yes.
And is, and becomes signify the present now.
Certainly.
So if the one has no share of time whatsoever, it never has become, nor was becoming, nor ever was. It hasn't now become, isn't becoming, isn't, and it won't become, won't come to be, and won't be hereafter.
Quite true.
Is there any way for something to share in being, except along one of these lines?
There is not.
Then the one has no share in being whatsoever.
It seems not.
Then the one in no way is.
It doesn't appear to.
Then it isn't even in such a way as to be one. For it would already be, and would share in being, but it seems, if we're to trust an argument like this, that the one neither is one nor is at all.
So it seems.
But can there be anything belonging to, or of, what does not exist, for that non-existent thing?
How could there?
Then it has no name, no account, no knowledge, no perception, and no opinion of it either.
It doesn't appear so.
So it isn't named, isn't spoken of, isn't opined about, isn't known, and nothing that exists perceives it.
It seems not.
Is it even possible for things to stand this way regarding the one?
I certainly don't think so.
Shall we go back to our starting assumption then, and see if something different appears to us on going back over it?
Yes, I'd very much like that.
We're saying then, if one is, we must come to agreement about what follows for it, whatever that turns out to be.
Isn't that so?
Yes.
Look then, right from the start.
If one is, can it be, without sharing in being?
It cannot.
Then the being of the one would also exist, not being the same thing as the one. Otherwise, that being wouldn't be the being of that thing, nor would the one share in it, but it would be just like saying, one is, and, one. But that's not our assumption now. Not what must follow if one is one, but what must follow if one is.
Isn't that so?
Certainly.
So, is must mean something different from one.
Necessarily.
So, whenever someone says in a single phrase that one is, wouldn't this just mean that the one shares in being?
Quite so.
Let's say again then, what follows if one is.
Consider whether this assumption doesn't necessarily mean that the one, being such as it is, has parts.
How so?
Like this.
If is said of the one that is, and one is said of the being that is one, and being and the one aren't the same thing, yet both belong to that same thing we assumed. Namely the one that is, isn't it necessary that the one that is, being a whole, is itself one thing, and that one and being become parts of it?
Necessary.
Shall we call each of these two parts merely a part,
or must each part be called a part of the whole?
Of the whole.
Then whatever is one is also a whole, and has a part.
Quite so.
Well then, of these two parts of the one that is, the one and the being, does either the one fall short of the part being, or the being fall short of the part one?
That couldn't be.
Then again, each of these parts too has the one and the being, and the smallest part again turns out to consist of two parts, and so on always, by the same reasoning. Whatever turns out to be a part always has these two parts, since the one always has being, and being always has the one. So whatever keeps becoming two can never be one.
Absolutely right.
Then wouldn't the one, existing in this way, be unlimited in multitude?
It seems so.
Come now, look at it this way too.
How?
We say the one shares in being, and that's why it is.
Yes.
And it's because of this that the one being one turned out to be many.
Just so.
But now, this one itself, which we say shares in being, if we grasp it by itself in thought, apart from that in which we say it shares, will it show up as just one? Or will this very thing also turn out to be many?
One, I should think.
Let's see then. Its being must be one thing and it itself another, if indeed the one isn't being, but as one, has partaken of being.
Necessary.
So if being is one thing and the one is another, it's not by being one that the one differs from being, nor by being being that being differs from the one, but they differ from each other by the different and the other.
Certainly.
So, the different is the same as neither the one nor the being.
How could it be?
Now then, if we pick out, say, being and the different, or being and the one, or the one and the different, don't we in each choice pick out a pair that it's right to call both?
How so?
Like this. Can one say being?
One can.
And again say one.
That too.
Hasn't each of them, then, been named?
Yes.
And when I say being and one, haven't I named both?
Certainly.
And likewise if I say being and different, or different and one, in every case I'm naming a pair.
Yes.
Now whatever pair is rightly called by both names, can it be both of these and yet not two?
It cannot.
And if they're two, is there any way for each of them not to be one?
None.
So since each of these pairs turns out to be a couple, each of them would also be one.
So it appears.
And if each of them is one, then when anyone whatever is added to any pairing, doesn't the sum become three?
Yes.
And three is odd, while two is even.
Of course.
Well then, where there are two, mustn't there also be twice? And where three, thrice, given that two carries within it twice one, and three carries thrice one?
Necessary.
And given two and twice, isn't there necessarily two times two? And given three and thrice, isn't there necessarily three times three?
How could it be otherwise?
And again, given three and twice, and two and thrice, mustn't there be two times three and three times two?
Very much so.
So there would be even numbers taken evenly, and odd numbers taken oddly, and even taken oddly, and odd taken evenly.
That's how it stands.
If that's so, do you think there's any number left over that need not exist?
None whatsoever.
So if one is, number must also be.
Necessary.
But if number exists, there would be many things, indeed an unlimited multitude of things that are, or doesn't number, unlimited in multitude, itself come to share in being?
It certainly does.
So if every number shares in being, wouldn't each part of number also share in it?
Yes.
Then being is distributed over all the many things there are, and is absent from none of them, neither the smallest nor the greatest, or is that an absurd question to even ask?
Absurd indeed, for how could being be absent from anything that is?
No way at all. So it has been cut up into pieces as small and as great as can be in every possible way, and has been divided more thoroughly than anything, and its parts are without limit.
That's how it stands.
Then its parts are the most numerous of all things.
Most numerous indeed.
Well then, is there any one of them that is a part of being, and yet no part at all?
How could that be?
No, rather, if it exists at all, it must, I think, always be some one thing so long as it exists, and it's impossible for it to be nothing.
Necessary.
So the one is attached to every single part of being, never absent from any part, whether smaller or greater or of any other size.
So it is.
Is the one then, being one, present as a whole in many places at the same time?
Consider that.
I am considering it, and I see that it's impossible.
Then it's divided up, if it isn't whole. For there's no other way it could be present to all the parts of being at once, except by being divided.
True.
And what is divisible must be exactly as many as its parts.
Necessary.
So what we said just now wasn't true, when we said that being is distributed into the most parts of all.
For it isn't divided into more parts than the one, but into parts equal to the one, as it seems, since neither does being fall short of the one, nor the one of being, but the two of them are everywhere equal, matched against each other throughout.
That's exactly how it appears.
So the one itself, cut up into pieces by being, is many, and unlimited in multitude.
So it appears.
So it's not only being one that turns out to be many, but the one itself, distributed by being, must also be many.
And surely, since the parts belong to a whole, the one would be limited in respect of the whole.
Or are the parts not contained by the whole?
They must be.
And what contains would be a limit?
Of course.
So the one that is would be both one and many, both whole and parts, both limited and unlimited in number.
So it appears.
Then since it is limited, doesn't it also have extremities?
It must.
And again, if it is a whole, wouldn't it have a beginning, a middle, and an end?
Or can anything be a whole without these three?
No, if even one of them is missing, will it still consent to be whole?
It will not.
So the one, it seems, would have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
It would.
But surely the middle is equidistant from the extremities, otherwise it wouldn't be a middle.
True.
And being such, the one would partake of some shape, either straight or round or some mixture of the two.
It would partake of one of these.
Being so constituted, then, won't it be both in itself and in another?
How so?
Each of the parts is surely in the whole, and none outside the whole.
That's so.
And all the parts are contained by the whole.
Yes.
And surely all the parts, taken together, are the one, no more and no less than all.
True.
So the whole too is the one.
Of course.
If then, all the parts happen to be in the whole, and the whole is both all the parts and itself, and the whole contains all the parts, then the one would be contained by the one, and thus the one itself would already be in itself.
So it appears.
But then again, the whole is not in its parts, neither in all of them nor in any one. For if it were in all, it would have to be in one. For if it were not in some one part, it could hardly be in all of them. And if this one part is among all of them, but the whole is not in it, how could it still be in all of them?
It couldn't.
Nor is it in some of the parts. For if the whole were in some, the greater would be in the less, which is impossible.
Impossible, yes.
And not being in several parts, nor in one, nor in all the parts, mustn't it be in something else, or be nowhere at all?
It must.
And being nowhere, it would be nothing. But being a whole, since it is not in itself, it must be in something else.
Quite so.
So insofar as the one is a whole, it is in another. But insofar as it happens to be all its parts, it is in itself. And thus the one must be both in itself and in another.
It must.
Being naturally so constituted, mustn't the one also be both in motion and at rest?
In what way?
It is at rest, surely, if it is in itself. For being in one thing and not shifting from it, it would be in the same thing, namely itself.
It is, indeed.
And what is always in the same thing must surely always be at rest.
Quite so.
But what about this? What is always in another? Mustn't the opposite hold, that it is never in the same thing, and never being in the same thing is not at rest either, and not being at rest is in motion?
So it seems.
So the one, being always both in itself and in another,
must always be both in motion and at rest.
So it appears. And surely it must be the same as itself and different from itself. And likewise it must be the same as and different from the others, if indeed it has undergone what came before.
How so? Everything, in relation to everything else, stands thus. Either it is the same or different, or, if it is neither the same nor different, it would be a part of that to which it so relates, or it would stand to it as a whole to a part.
So it appears.
Is the one, then, a part of itself?
By no means.
Then it wouldn't be a whole in relation to itself as a part, being a part of itself.
No, that couldn't be.
But is the one different from one?
Certainly not.
Nor, then, could it be different from itself.
No, indeed.
If, then, it is neither different, nor a whole, nor a part in relation to itself, isn't it now necessary that it be the same as itself?
It must be.
But then, what's in one place being itself, while it is in the same place as itself? Mustn't it be different from itself, if indeed it will also be elsewhere?
So it seems to me.
And this is just how the one was shown to be, both in itself, and, at the same time, in another.
It was shown so.
Then in this respect the one would be different from itself, it seems.
It seems so.
Well then, if a thing is different from something, won't it be different from something different?
It must.
And all the things that are not one are different from the one, and the one is different from the things that are not one.
Of course.
So the one would be different from the others.
Different.
Now look, aren't sameness and difference themselves opposites of each other?
Of course.
Would the same ever consent to be in the different, or the different in the same?
It would not consent.
So if the different will never be in the same, then there is nothing among the things that are in which the different is present for any time at all. For if it were in anything at all, for that time the different would be in the same.
Isn't that so?
It is so. And since it is never in the same, the different could never be in any of the things that are.
True.
Then the different would not be present either in the things that are not one, or in the one.
That follows.
So the one would not be different from the things that are not one by virtue of the different, nor would the things that are not one be different from the one by that means.
No, indeed.
Nor again would they be different from each other by being themselves, if they do not partake of the different.
How could they?
But if they are different neither by themselves nor by the different, wouldn't they altogether escape being different from each other?
They would escape it.
But surely the things that are not one do not partake of the one either, for otherwise they would not be not one, but would somehow be one.
True.
Nor could the things that are not one be a number. For then, too, they would not be altogether not one, if they had number.
No, indeed.
Well, then, are the things that are not one parts of the one? Or would the things that are not one partake of the one in that way, too?
They would partake of it that way.
If, then, the one is entirely one thing and the others are entirely not one, the one could not be a part of the things that are not one, nor a whole of them as parts. Nor again, could the things that are not one be parts of the one, nor wholes with the one as their part?
No, indeed.
But we said that things which are neither parts, nor wholes, nor different from one another, would be the same as one another.
We did say that.
Shall we say, then, that the one, standing thus in relation to the things that are not one, is the same as they are?
Let's say so.
So the one, it seems, is both different from the others and from itself, and the same as both them and itself.
It certainly appears so, from the argument at least.
Is it then also both like and unlike itself and the others?
Perhaps.
Since it was shown to be different from the others too would surely be different from it.
Of course.
And is it different from the others in the same degree that they are different from it, neither more nor less?
Why would it be otherwise?
If then, neither more nor less, then equally.
Yes.
So insofar as it has undergone being different from the others, and they likewise from it, in that respect the one and the others would have undergone the same thing as each other.
How do you mean? Like this, don't you apply each of your names to something?
I do. And could you utter the same name more than once, or only once?
I could utter it more than once.
And if you utter it once, do you name that of which the name is the name, and if many times, do you not name it?
Or whether you speak the same name once or many times, mustn't you necessarily always mean the same thing?
Of course.
And isn't different to a name for something?
Certainly.
So whenever you utter it, whether once or many times, you are naming nothing else, and calling nothing else than that of which it is the name.
Necessarily.
So when we say that the others are different from the one, and the one is different from the others, in saying different twice, we are not thereby naming some other nature, but always naming that very nature whose name it is.
Quite so.
So insofar as the one is different from the others and the others from the one, by that very fact of being different, the one would have undergone nothing other than what the others have undergone. And what has undergone the same thing is like, isn't that so?
Yes.
So insofar as the one has undergone being different from the others, in that very respect everything would be like everything, for everything is different from everything.
So it seems.
But surely, the like is opposite to the unlike.
Yes.
And the different is opposite to the same as well.
That too.
But this too was shown, that the one is the same as the others.
It was shown.
And being the same as the others is the opposite condition to being different from the others.
Quite so.
But insofar as it is different, it was shown to be like.
Yes.
So insofar as it is the same, it will be unlike, by the opposite condition to the one that made it like. For the different, surely, made it like.
Yes.
So the same will make it unlike, or else it will not be the opposite of the different.
So it seems.
So the one will be both like and unlike the others. Like insofar as it is different, unlike insofar as it is the same. And it does seem to have this argument too, it seems.
Yes, and it has this one as well.
Which one? Insofar as it has undergone being the same, it has undergone not being of another sort, and not being of another sort, it is not unlike, and not being unlike, it is like. But insofar as it has undergone being different, it is of another sort, and being of another sort, it is unlike.
True.
So the one, being both the same as the others and different from them, on both these grounds and on each separately, would be both like and unlike the others.
Quite so.
And likewise toward itself as well. Since it was shown to be both different from itself and the same as itself, on both these grounds and on each, will it not appear both like and unlike itself?
Necessarily.
Now then, consider the question of the one's touching itself and the others, and of not touching, in respect of contact.
I'm considering it.
The one was shown to be, in itself, within the whole of itself.
Rightly so.
And is the one also within the others?
Yes.
So insofar as it is within the others, it would touch the others. But insofar as it is in itself, it would be kept from touching the others, while touching itself, being within itself.
So it appears.
So in this way the one would touch both itself and the others.
It would touch them.
But what about this? Mustn't everything that is going to touch something lie next to that which it is to touch, occupying the position which, next to that in which the thing lies, would touch it?
It must.
So the one too, if it is going to touch itself, must lie immediately next to itself, occupying the place adjoining that in which it itself is.
Yes, it must.